Well, my notes tell me that we have some visitors today, Baraboo High School students. If you are here, will you please stand? Well, very good. Thank you for making the drive down. We'd like to have students attend our oral arguments. You may be. Also, my notes say that a group of students from Classical Conversations are here. If they are, will they please stand? Well, that's wonderful. Can you tell me what Classical Conversations is? Can someone just let us know? It's a wonderful title. So,
it's a classically taught homeschool.
Very good. Very nice. Well, thank you very much for coming. Please be seated. Before we begin our second case of the day, you will note we are sitting five and we have an empty chair at either end. And I had our marshal do a little bit of rearranging of name tags so we would all be together, a little bit easier for you to deal with in regard to, you know, posing your arguments to us. We sit five on this case. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley and Justice Shirley Abrahamson have withdrawn from participation. Are you prepared to begin?
Yes.
All right, then I will call our case, LG versus Aurora Residential Alternatives.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Donna Fudge, and I am proud to represent the petitioners in this matter. The issue presented for your review is whether an order denying a motion to compel arbitration is immediately appealable as a matter of right under either Wisconsin Statute 808.031 or, alternatively, under the Federal Arbitration Act, which, of course, I shall refer to today as the FAA.
Why should we be looking at the FAA at all? We have our own law.
You should be looking at the FAA for, number one, the concept of freedom of contract. The parties in this case exercised their freedom of contract by expressly incorporating the FAA into their arbitration agreement. And not only did they do that, they expressly stated they wanted all 16 sections, sections 1 through 16 of the FAA, to apply, and they took it one step further. They explained that they wanted any inconsistent state law that was inconsistent with those 16 sections of the FAA to be preempted.
So do they get to contractually change our appellate procedure?
I believe they can, Your Honor. And I believe if you
where's the authority for that come from?
Number one, the fundamental right to freedom of contract. Number two, if you'll
have we ever held that the freedom of contract encompasses changing our appellate procedure?
I believe if you look to the Concepcion case, the United States Supreme Court case, it will lead you solidly to the conclusion that that can be done. In that case, an arbitration agreement was governed by the FAA, as is ours. And in that case, the court said that states may not force their procedures on parties to an arbitration agreement. When those procedures are inconsistent with either the objectives of the FAA or with the parties bargained for benefits of the alternative forum called arbitration.
So how does this preempt our procedures here in Wisconsin? It's a different timeline, right? If it followed the FAA, they have to appeal. You would have had to appeal within 30 days as opposed to 45. So how is that preemption?
It sets up a very different scheme. The FAA places the right to appeal at the front end of the case. Moment in time in the litigation where there's still time left to help preserve the bargain for benefits of arbitration. That's the entire scheme of the FAA Section 16. It says if the trial court grants the motion for arbitration, you got to go all the way through the case to a verdict and a final judgment before you can appeal. However, if the trial court denies the motion to compel arbitration, FAA 16A gives a beeline, guaranteed immediate right to go to the appellate court and have a second set of eyes scrutinize that circuit court order to see if there's been a mistake. And the reason that scheme is
16A, though, does not give a generalized immediate right to appeal. I mean, it has has a variety of very specific subsections. So, for example, at page 30 of your brief, you say the reason for such preemption of the 808.03 permissive appeal comes from the clear language of 16A1B of the FAA. Under that section, the FAA grants an immediate appeal as of right to an order denying a motion to compel arbitration. But that's not everything that 16A1B says, is it?
Well, you have to look at 16A, the first two parts of that. And what you'll see is that it grants the right to an appeal to, quote, an order, end quote. There's no limitation language in the text of 16A saying it exempts state courts.
Yeah, except that it says that section applies to an order, quote, denying a petition under Section 4 of this title to order arbitration to proceed. Right?
That is correct. But okay. If you go to the previous section that you're reading from, you'll see it grants an immediate right to appeal as of right to any order in any action that refuses a Section 3 motion to stay the court action, which is exactly what the circuit court order did in our case. It refused our motion to stay the trial court action. And
under
because
Section
there's no
3.
Exception in the text of Section 16 saying that Congress didn't intend it to apply to the states, and because we know Section 16 in the FAA was enacted under interstate commerce, then the courts have concluded that Section 16 should apply even in state court actions. The backing up to 808.03.1, I believe the circuit court order should be viewed as a final order under that Section 1 of the Wisconsin statute.
How does it meet the definition in that section as a final order?
It does because it disposed of the, quote, entire matter in litigation. And the reason it did that is because we need to look at that phrase, the matter in litigation. First of all, that's singular matter. It doesn't say all of the matters in litigation.
It says the entire matter.
Right, but the entire matter in litigation, when you're talking about arbitrability, is the matter of contract law and whether the case in the litigation matter will be compelled into the arbitration arena. So the matter, the entire matter, is the arbitrability of that case. And
how does that response fit with our jurisprudence that says unless the agreement specifically so states, the question of whether an issue is arbitrable is for the circuit court in the first instance?
That's an easy answer here, because in the parties' arbitration agreement, if you look at Section C on page 1 of the 5-page arbitration agreement, Section C sets forth a very detailed what's called a delegation clause. And that clause delegated even threshold gateway disputes
to
the arbitrator, and it includes disputes over scope, interpretation, and it expressly included disputes over arbitrability. We know from Mortimer, and we know from recently Henry Schein out of the United States Supreme Court, parties have the freedom of contract to even revise the procedures set forth in the FAA. They can design and craft their own rules, even if they're different.
You know, in order to buy your argument, we'd have to conclude that the petition to arbitrate was a special proceeding. That concerns me just a bit. And when I was reading all the materials everybody filed, I kept thinking, oh, there's a case where if sovereign immunity is denied, then you have an immediate right to appeal. So through discussions with my colleagues and my law clerk, we found Arneson versus Jerwitsky, which essentially says that in a context of qualified immunity, if that defense is raised and it is denied, there is a right for immediate interlocutory appeal. Now, that's not going to help you because you missed the time date for interlocutory appeal. But why isn't that a better process going forward, since we aren't just deciding the case for you, we're deciding it for people to come down the road later?
Well, first, I would say that under Wisconsin's definition of a final order, it says that it applies whether or not the order is rendered in an action or a special proceeding.
Right, but we'd have to determine, as I started my question with, determining that demanding that arbitration proceed, that motion begins a special proceeding, or is a special proceeding, I guess, in and of itself, rather than part of the pending action.
It can be both. In our situation, there was already an action filed, because despite the parties bargained for agreement for arbitration, LG elected to go to the circuit court and file a lawsuit.
Right.
So an action was already pending. My client then responded to that with the motion to compel arbitration. At that point, the entire matter in litigation was the arbitrability of the case. And when the circuit court denied that motion...
What about the merits of the case that he filed? Why isn't that part of the litigation?
It's part of the underlying merits of the litigation.
Well, but it's part of the action, the claims that are presented by the complaint, right?
But in order to be a final order, the order does not need to dispose of all of the matters in the underlying litigation. Let me give you an example.
How about a motion to suppress evidence?
I'm not a criminal lawyer.
Is that a special proceeding?
I don't know the answer to that, but what I do know is in criminal law,
a motion to compel discovery, that's civil. How about a motion to compel discovery that's decided in one person's favor or the other? Is that a special proceeding?
I don't believe so, and I believe that's a very different animal than when we're talking about arbitration, because there's a whole body of law that provides special treatment to arbitration agreements. And I think the benefit of an arbitration agreement is only realized when the parties get that benefit at the outset of the case, which, again, is the moment in time when there's still time left for them to capture those benefits. Under the circuit court's order in this case, what will have to happen, if it stands, is we will have to go all the way through the litigation process in the courthouse, a place where, under the arbitration agreement, by the way, it says we want to completely avoid the court system, but we're going to have to go all the way through a jury trial and get a final judgment before we even have the right to appeal.
Well, this case, but other people that stand in your shoes, and I'm sure there are many contracts that require arbitration, if the court were to determine that you had a right of interlocutory appeal, that won't help your client, but it would perhaps clarify the law and permit arbitration to be heard before the right to arbitrate is lost, right?
Well, first of all, the interlocutory appeal under the Wisconsin system is only permissive. We have to ask permission, may or may not...
Just slow down a minute, okay? If you look at the Arneson case, that's exactly what we did. We said you have a right, okay, for an interlocutory appeal. And we did that under our superintending authority so that that right would not be lost, because if it were not exercised immediately, it was lost, just as you're arguing to us about the contract to arbitrate. If it's not given go-ahead immediately, when the case is all done, then you've lost the right. It's the same parallel in my view.
Under the circuit court order, you're changing the bargain for benefit here. The parties bargained for the rules of FAA 16 to apply. 16A gives an immediate guaranteed right to seek appellate review and scrutinize the order. Permissive appeals may or may not be granted, as we've given examples. I just had it happen to me in Milwaukee County in December. So circuit courts are denying, appellate courts are denying the opportunity to give permissive review. And the only way to be consistent here with the objectives of the FAA and to allow parties the benefit of the bargain is to make sure that orders denying motions to compel arbitration are immediately appealable at the outset of the case as a matter of right.
Could you please give me that cite to that case that you mentioned earlier when we were having discussion about freedom to contract, and freedom to contract being the right to contract for a particular appellate procedure?
I think I would look to AT&T versus Concepcion, and there it was looking at California state procedures. And it said a state cannot force those procedures on parties to an arbitration agreement when those procedures are inconsistent with the objectives of the FAA or with the bargain for benefit of arbitration.
So, for example, if someone has a choice of law provision in a contract, does that then mean that let's say our choice of law is New York? right? Does that mean that New York's appellate procedures apply to the Wisconsin court that's deciding the dispute? I almost see this FAA provision as a choice of law provision, but I wasn't familiar with the notion that that then controls appellate procedure, or at least not, as a lawyer, that's not how I looked at it, and as a judge, that's not how I looked at it. So I'm trying to figure out what your argument is.
I think we have to start by going with our agreement. We adopt the FAA. That's undeniable. It's undeniable that Section 2 of the FAA applies with equal force in state courts as it does in federal courts. It's undeniable that under Section 2, courts must enforce arbitration agreements as written, save upon grounds generally applicable for the revocation of any contract. So our contract adopted the rules of the FAA, including the appellate rule of 16A. How could that be revocable under generally applicable contract law when it's a term that's actually favored in arbitration, and countless arbitration agreements have adopted the FAA, and we have courts like Marmette and Kindred versus Clark and even KPGM versus Kachi. All those cases were United States Supreme Court cases reviewing a state court's denial of a motion to compel arbitration, and the court said all 16 sections of the arbitration apply with equal force on that state court.
Well, let's look at that proposition just a little bit. Are you suggesting that the FAA has field preemptive force?
I'm not sure what you mean by field preemptive force.
So field preemption is when a federal law occupies a particular field, okay, to the exclusion of state courts. Are you saying that the FAA occupies the field of arbitrations to the exclusion of state courts?
Yes, if the state rule or the state procedure or the state court holding is inconsistent with the main objectives of the FAA. The answer to your question then is yes.
Right.
States
so
are free
on,
to develop procedures
on,
that are
hang
consistent.
Hang on just a second. I just want to make sure we get our terms straight here. So field preemption says, state, you may not pass any laws on this subject, period, right? If it's not field preemption, then the federal law only preempts if it expressly says it does. Okay, so which one of these are we dealing with here?
Okay, to be clear, it wouldn't be field preemption then, because states are free to develop their own arbitration rules.
Okay.
When you have a contract like ours, though, that where the FAA applies, the FAA will preempt. Conflict preemption is what it's called.
Now you have to show what part of the FAA expressly conflicts with state court procedure. And here what you're suggesting is that the federal appellate procedures in the FAA are expressly meant to preempt state appellate procedure, right?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
How do you get the FAA appellate procedure in state court?
Okay, I'm sorry. Because the FAA has 16 sections.
Yeah, if you go
to the back of it, Section 16 is the section that governs appealability of orders on motions to compel arbitration.
In federal court.
In federal court. And if you look at Marmette, and if you look at KPMG versus Kachi, you will see the court discussed in that case what was the, quote, FAA's coverage when it comes to state court actions, which is what they were dealing with. And the court said, quote, 9 U.S.C. Section 1 et sec. must be enforced even in state courts.
So that would mean
Sections 1 through 16. Excuse me.
Are there any limitations then? What I hear you saying is that parties can contract for other appellate procedures. So two parties, doesn't matter who they are, they could say, we've decided to contract for immediate review in the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
They could, because that would be consistent with the objectives of the FAA to provide immediate guaranteed rights of appeal at the front end of the litigation rather than at the back end after a final judgment.
And then unlike any other case, we would be required to take that case.
Yes.
Can I move you back away from the FAA? You're hearing probably some skepticism from the bench, so I want to take you back to our statute, which is, I think, your first argument, because if we resolve the case in your favor under 808.03, we don't need to address preemption under the FAA, right?
Correct.
So neither party cited to State v. Scott, which is a criminal law case that the court just issued last year, but it does address what is a special proceeding. And in the context of that case, the defendant was determined to be incompetent to stand trial. So there was a competency proceeding that took place separate and apart from the criminal law issues in the underlying case. So what happens in that situation is the court basically suspends the criminal law proceedings and waits to see how the defendant can be restored to competency. So the ruling in that case was that an order determining incompetency and mandating involuntary medication or treatment to restore competency is a final order issued in a special proceeding and is appealable as of right. There was no separate proceeding initiated or action. There was one criminal proceeding, and the competency issue was addressed within the context of that criminal proceeding. But nonetheless, the court held the order of the circuit court in the competency proceeding disposed of the entire matter in litigation between the parties, namely the question of the defendant's competency to assist with post-conviction proceedings and the defendant's competency to refuse medication or treatment. So it's actually a question I'd like both parties to address. Can we apply or should we apply State v. Scott in this context as well?
I believe you can, and thank you for pointing that out. I believe the example is very akin to what we have in our case. By analogy, the question of the mental capacity of that person in the case you mentioned was the entire matter. Comparing that to our situation, the entire matter under our motion was the arbitrability of the claims. Our motion had nothing to do with the underlying merits of the case. And the minute the circuit court issued its order denying arbitrability, that entire matter in the litigation was done. We were at a roadblock. We were at a dead end.
So in other words, arbitrability is something that needs to be decided before it is determined whether the case will proceed under arbitration or under traditional court proceedings, just like the issue of competency must be resolved before the criminal trial can proceed in that context.
Correct.
All right, taking you to what you said a number of times, you've talked about the benefit of the bargain. Here, how can you possibly hold this individual responsible for the bargain didn't occur until after these acts. So even if we accept all of your arguments here and we set some guidelines for the courts about how this process should work, this was a contract, as you said, the freedom to contract, and it was made after these facts that led to this alleged, and actually he was convicted of, sexual assault. So how can you possibly hold someone to a bargain that wasn't yet made?
First of all, what you just raised is an issue about scope and the debate about how to interpret the arbitration agreement, whether or not it included that 2012 sexual contact event. First and foremost, the issue of scope and any debates about it or its interpretation had been expressly delegated to the arbitrator. So under Henry Schein and this court's case, well, that decision, the circuit court had no power, no authority to reach the decision about whether or not the scope of the party's arbitration agreement could reach back and cover the 2012 event. And it's important that at the circuit court level, LG failed to challenge with, quote, specificity, end quote, the validity of that delegation clause in Section C of the arbitration agreement. LG challenged the five-page arbitration agreement as a whole. We know from Rent-A-Center, et cetera, that challenge also would have to go to the arbitrator. So because she did not specifically challenge the validity of the delegation clause, the case law is clear. The circuit court had to find it was valid and enforce that delegation clause and send the scope debate off to arbitration and allow it to be decided in that arena.
Counselor, could you point to me where in AT&T versus Concepcion there is the proposition that the FAA preempts state procedural law?
I don't know that I can give you an exact page, but what I can tell you there is that it had to do with the California state procedural rules that were trying to implicate the party's bargained for ability to have arbitration, and the court looked to the FAA and its objectives, and it said that notwithstanding any state substantive or procedural policies to the contrary, the FAA and the party's contract had to be enforced. And I believe a pretty close to a quote is, states cannot force their procedures on parties to an arbitration agreement, even if those state rules are for an unrelated desirable purpose. So that's important because it's not like the state rule that we're looking at needs to be outright hostile toward arbitration or even discriminate against arbitration. All that's necessary to show FAA preemption is that the state law, when applied, merely is inconsistent and hinders the accomplishments of the objectives of the FAA.
Would you have filed an action to arbitrate this contract independently if there wasn't a circuit court action pending?
Could we have gone and filed for arbitration?
Right. You knew that people weren't agreeing about things and circuit court action wasn't filed. Could you have filed for arbitration to determine that the dispute that y'all were talking about was arbitrable?
I guess we could, but there wasn't a dispute yet. I mean, the first we knew that there was a dispute was when the lawsuit was filed.
Okay, that's fair enough. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think your red light is on.
Oh.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. It's an honor to be here today. My name is James Bees from the law firm of Bowler and Vaughn. I'm here with Matthew Bowler today. And I represent a woman who goes by LG in this action. She's under protective placement, a mentally disabled woman who appears by her court-appointed guardian, Chippewa Family Services Incorporated. I'm here today to argue that the Court of Appeals should be affirmed. I'd like to address some of the questions that have been raised in the previous argument, but I really have essentially four short points in supplement to the briefing in this case that I'd like to argue really quickly. Number one, there's clearly a right to appeal any order of the circuit court. The key distinction is what procedure you have to follow to secure that appeal. The appellants here chose not to use sub 2 of 80803 and file a petition for leave to appeal in a timely manner. So no one has been robbed of an appeal this case. In fact, it's been presented as kind of arbitration is a one-and-done issue in circuit court today. That's not my experience. In fact, that's not the experience in this case. There's now 5 pending appeals in the Court of Appeals and this court in this case, 4 of which have petitions for leave to appeal, and 3 petitions for leave to appeal in the Court of Appeals relate to arbitration issues raised with the circuit court, such as additional motions to compel arbitration, as well as a motion to reconsider that was filed last week. The circuit court denied that motion to reconsider. So arbitration is something that I think the case law makes clear can come up throughout an action. Parties are not required under the case law to move to compel arbitration at the beginning of an action. In fact, there's case law suggesting that a party can participate in discovery before moving for arbitration. Some parties might elect to, for lack of a better way of saying it, let it ride until they find out more facts and find out that a dispute is clearly arbitrable.
In this contract, there's the refusal to arbitrate provision, which says basically if one party refuses to go forward, then the arbitration goes forward and a decision can be rendered. What would preclude them from going forward, getting a decision, and a attempting to confirm that in the circuit court?
At this point, it's a little late in the game, I think, to do that. They may have been able to do that before there was an action filed. The circuit court has, at this point, determined that there is the first step in making of a contract has not been satisfied for arbitration. So in this particular procedural posture, unless and until it's reversed, the circuit court hasn't gotten to that level of, well, what's delegated and what's not. But we're not even at the first step yet.
Doesn't this arbitration agreement provide that even the issue of whether there's an agreement to arbitrate be decided by the arbitrators?
The making of a contract, in order to force us to arbitrate, they would have to pursue an action in the circuit court under 78803 to force us to do that, or move in an action to force us to do that under 78802, which is what they did. And so there is a antecedent question of whether there is even a contract to begin with that the circuit court can't,
and that's
that has to deal
with. Answering for me. Doesn't the agreement call for the decision on whether there's a contract to arbitrate be decided by the arbitrator?
Yes, it is incredibly broad in that respect. But
so isn't that a decision for the arbitrator?
I don't think that the circuit court can give up that initial determination. There are some cases suggesting that, for example, there's a new decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, New Prime, in which the U.S. Supreme Court decided that the initial question of, well, does the Federal Arbitration Act apply to an arbitration agreement, the employment exception, courts have to decide that. So there are certain antecedent matters that even if a document says it, the law is that the courts are still empowered to decide those questions.
Counsel, I'd like to explore a little bit the interplay between 78802 with respect to the right to an immediate appeal of a decision on an order compelling arbitration. So let's say that your client actually wanted to arbitrate and Aurora was refusing. You could bring a petition to the circuit court seeking an order compelling arbitration under 78803. Is that correct?
Correct.
And if the court denied that order, it would be immediately appealable.
Yes, because it satisfied the standard of finality in 80803.
So let's say that this is the situation as it actually is. You don't want to arbitrate. You want a court case. And so you bring your civil action, and the defendant says, well, I do want to arbitrate, and so files an application in the circuit court for an order staying the action pending arbitration. And your position is that the court's decision on that application is not immediately appealable. Is that right?
Right, because of the all matters in litigation test set out by the statute.
So why is the immediate appealability of the circuit court's determination on whether arbitration should go forward, why does that depend on whether the plaintiff wants arbitration or the plaintiff wants a court action?
It doesn't depend on who wants what. It depends on whether the standard for all matters in litigation is satisfied in a given action. This is a
right, but that's just because you beat the other to the courthouse, right? And it's your civil action that gets filed before a petition to compel arbitration. I mean, that's what decides the immediate appealability of the question of arbitrability, isn't it?
It is, but that's how the Wisconsin Arbitration Act is structured.
Well, okay, so
at least has been interpreted.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about the language in 78802, which refers to not a motion to stay the action pending arbitration, but an application to stay the action. What's the difference between a motion and an application?
If it's in the context of an existing action, I think it means the same thing.
Then why did the legislature choose application instead of motion? Legislature knows what a motion is, right?
Sure. Well, that particular subsection mirrors the FAA Section 3. And so
and in the FAA,
yeah,
that's immediately appealable.
Because of Section 16, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Before Section 16 came around, it was significantly more confusing whether it would have been. So, point number two. There's been a little bit of discussion in the briefs about whether this is a settled issue of law or not. I have not seen a case cited in any of the briefs in which the Court of Appeals has treated over decades a motion, order denying a motion to compel arbitration in an existing action as a final order. I would just submit that that creates expectations for the bench and the bar. I think that the Court of Appeals has been addressing this issue pretty consistently over the years, and I think that that should be given some weight.
If you give it some weight, how about saying it's not a final order, but you have a right of interlocutory appeal, rather than it being permissive, you have a right to interlocutory appeal?
I think there's a specific way of doing that if the court is interested in pursuing that. One of the cases we cited in our brief from the Georgia Supreme Court, the JAPE case, it was a preemption issue. The court decided there was no FAA preemption of a discretionary appeal standard, but one thing it did in footnote 3 of the decision mm-hmm. is it went ahead and said, we're going to give some guidance to the Court of Appeals on these issues and say, when you get a petition, you should grant it except in clear cases. And so this court has done similar things in the past mm-hmm. on other issues, and if this court felt mm-hmm. that it wanted to minimize the potential for errors in the Court of Appeals' discretion, it could certainly do that.
Okay. And I think that's similar to what we did in the Arneson case that I mentioned to opposing counsel,
right.
where it really dealt with qualified immunity, and we said, well, you have a right to interlocutory appeal. So we changed under our superintending authority from it being a permissive possibility to a right because of the same kind of concerns opposing counsel is bringing to us, that if this isn't realized right away, the right that was contracted for to arbitrate disappears.
Right. And I think there's even another way to attack it as well if you didn't
okay.
want to go that far.
Okay.
In my view, the factors set out in 809.50
okay.
to in the exercise of the Court of Appeals discretion, that three-factor test, I think this court also could give some guidance on what that means and how arbitration-related policies are incorporated into that statute. For example, there's been concerns aired in the briefing about, we can't unring the bell if this motion is denied and we
right.
have to move forward. Well, that to me would seem to be a pretty good argument for substantial, such that the Court of Appeals would be required to take the case under it.
It's similar to...
They're similar, but I think that if this court didn't want to outright command it, there are other forms of guidance that it could provide to the Court of Appeal
okay,
in order
you.
To make sure there's not mistakes made.
Okay, thank you.
So third
now,
point.
You
go ahead.
It may be your third point. Maybe
no.
that's where you're going to.
Well,
I'm wondering why there's no meeting of the minds, because that was something that you felt was very important.
Sure. Well, this gets at a little bit of the merits that I think we're going to get to if this court reverses, but or for that matter, if any of the other pending petitions are accepted. But there's a number of reasons, really, that are going to be hashed out. Number one, I don't think the guardian's signature alone in the context of settling a cause of action is enough to create a binding agreement in this circumstance. Under the minor and incompetent settlement statute, there was no guardian ad litem input. There was no court input. This lady is entitled to some minimum basic level of due process so that a corporation and a corporation don't get together and waive her constitutional rights, all appointed by a state court. Number two, there are a number of state and federal cases that have found that parties, even under the broadest arbitration language, don't contract to include sexual assaults within a contract for services. There's a number of famous cases of the federal courts related to Halliburton sexual assaults on cruise lines that we've cited, where the courts have looked at this and said, well, this is unquestionably broad language, but when you're contracting for something, you're never contracting for this as a matter of law. Those would be some of the arguments we would present.
Okay. Thank you.
So the third point was I just wanted to get why I don't think this is a special proceeding.
Okay.
I think the case law sets out some good guideposts, and I wanted to address the State versus Scott question here. In the case law, I think State versus Scott, I read the case. We didn't cite it. As I remember it, the court relied on the Voss case heavily in that, in which the Voss case, that case talks about whether something's merely connected to an action or if it's intertwined. It's a different way of phrasing some of the things this court has also said, like in Alger and in and the Court of Appeals has said in Wellens. I think they're all saying similar things. And some of the guideposts that have been offered are whether there's a filing outside of an action, whether, as the Wellens court said, if all you're trying to do is relieve yourself from having to appear in an action, you're probably filing a motion within an action and not a special proceeding. I also want to just relay one of my concerns about this special proceeding argument. I think what we're talking about here is not necessarily one special proceeding per case. As I've said before, we have a number of different arbitration motions in this case, so we're probably talking about a series of special proceedings, or this court may have to figure out which one is final within a special proceeding, and I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Yeah, well, you know, in probate, we do that.
We do.
We say there are a bunch of special proceedings, each one initiated by an order focused on some issue.
Exactly, and I think that's no surprise that a lot of the cases cited by the appellants are actually probate cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I think, what they're trying to propose here is more of a probate-style series of special proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that requiring the Court of Appeals to take all of those are going to have systemic consequences for the Court of Appeals docket that I'm not sure are best answered in this particular case. Certainly, I don't know what the numbers are, but I would hesitate to voice that on the Court of Appeals without having looked at it a little bit deeper as a systemic issue. So that's why I don't think it's a special proceeding.
Could you address the merely connected to or intertwined element? Because it strikes me that in the Scott case, the issue of competency is even more intertwined with the underlying criminal proceeding than what we have here, where it's, are we going on the arbitration track or are we going on the court track?
Sure. I think that that is a good point. And in Scott, I perceive there to be another thing on top of just merely intertwined, and that there's part of it is the ability to have your rights adjudicated and get to the appellate courts. Time was a factor, I believe, at least as I remember it in Scott. And so if you have, unlike this case, if you have a special proceeding that is disconnected in time from underlying proceeding, you may have a reason to make that finding. The intertwined element, however, I would say this as far as arbitration goes. Parties regularly plead arbitration as affirmative defense in the state, which this court has noted and this Court of Appeals has noted, which is a but-for, of course, in an action. There are a number of other contracts that are proffered over the course of actions similar to this. For example, I'm a tort lawyer. If somebody came and filed a summary judgment motion on an exculpatory contract that was denied, I think everyone would agree that's not final and it wasn't separate, even though a contract was made outside or before the incident happened.
But in these situations, doesn't it really benefit all of the parties to know whether, in fact, the matter is arbitrable? Because otherwise, you could go through a court proceeding all the way through trial, and we all know that that can take sometimes even years to actually happen, depending on how much discovery is necessary, only to have an appellate court say, oops, this should have been arbitrated. So then the parties are going to have to start over in an arbitration proceeding?
I agree with the sentiment, Your Honor, but I don't think it's as clear-cut in all cases. As I discussed before, some parties elect not to pursue arbitration until later in the case. Some parties sometimes things happen over the pendency of a case. For example, new parties or new causes of action are discovered that would revive the right to compel arbitration later. There is much to my chagrin a continuum of factors which arbitration comes up over the course of an action or maybe revived or reconsidered. And so one of the things I personally struggle with in this whole special proceeding argument is drawing those lines or attempting to draw those lines outside of the action.
But once the arbitration issue comes up, that is a potentially jurisdiction usurping question, isn't it?
If there's a valid arbitration agreement, it is. Potentially.
And what does the arbitration or what does this contract call for when it comes to a dispute as to whether an issue should be, how about a dispute as to whether there's a contract at all?
As I agreed to you on earlier, there is a delegation clause, although we did, contrary to what was said earlier, challenge that clause in the circuit court, that it even applies to this particular case because there's language in the arbitration agreement suggesting that it's also cabined to the matters for which are substantively arbitrable. Like they've said the same thing about what the scope of the delegation is and the scope of the arbitration.
Right, but the court's role is pretty limited, whether you like it or not. Under Wisconsin law, the court's role is quite limited in arbitration issues.
It is, and I would say in this particular case, the circuit court's role was limited. It didn't get past the first step. Whether that's error or not is not really what's before this court. What's before this court is whether that alleged error was properly before the Court of Appeals in this appeal. I intend to argue there is no error, but I see how reasonable minds could disagree, and we'll fight it out in the Court of Appeals, and I expect to win that, if that's the case, or if one of these other petitions are granted. So lastly, I want to talk about preemption, and I want to clarify a couple things. Section 16 of the FAA cross-references Section 3 and Section 4 of the FAA. Section 3 and Section 4 of the FAA state the courts of the refer to the courts of the United States, which is a term of art for federal court. The Volt Information Sciences case, the Southland case at the U.S. Supreme Court, and others have very famous footnotes saying we do not hold that these sections can apply in state court. And so a rule of law has grown out of that over the years with other states, with federal courts, where there is no field preemption here. That's Volt Information Sciences. It held that there is no intent for Congress to occupy the field. And so what we're really looking for here is whether there's a conflict. I would submit that the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, has defined that as well, in Concepcion and Kindred as well. There are two classes of anti-arbitration rules that would be preempted. Number one would be things that expressly ban arbitration. So like the Discover Bank rule in Concepcion, you can't have class waivers. That's unconscionable. That's a state trying to ban arbitration in a certain context. That's not here. The second category is things that seem facially neutral but are really arise from and relate to and kind of target arbitration. So an example of that is in the Kindred case for the U.S. Supreme Court, where the Kentucky Supreme Court had a rule saying you cannot waive your right to a jury trial under a POA, a power of attorney, without an express statement in the power of attorney authorizing that. The Supreme Court looked at that, and in Justice Kagan's opinion, she got to the crux of it, where she says, what does this really apply to other than arbitration, really? And it doesn't. You know, this is clearly aimed at and discriminates against arbitration.
You know, when you reference that one of the things that you can't ban is arbitration in certain contexts, it makes me think back to your earlier comments and answers to my questions that you can't arbitrate to remove a sexual assault action from the circuit court. How does that fit with what you just said?
That's one of those antecedent contractual matters, at least in my opinion, that before you're getting to banning arbitration in certain contexts, you're talking about what the parties would ever agree to in a contract, whether it's for services or...
Okay, so you're saying that they would not agree to that in a contract generally, but you couldn't say as a matter of state public policy that you can never arbitrate on the questions that's now before us?
Or before I guess it depends on the context, and I think the U.S. Supreme Court may not have been as clear on this in Concepcion as it could have been.
Yeah.
With respect to, at least with the issue before us today, which is the appellate rules of procedure,
yeah.
Number one, I don't think there's a conflict because 808 applies to all, everything equally. That being said, there are some limits to Congress's Commerce Clause powers. And in this context, there are several state court decisions we've cited in our brief where they've kind of alluded to this, that the federal government under its Commerce Clause power cannot tell you, the court, what is properly before you as an arm of state government. So that there's like the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in a case we cited in our brief said the Federal Arbitration Act doesn't reach that far. Thankfully, I don't think that Congress wrote federal arbitration law that way. It was specific in what it said about where the procedures apply, and so I don't think that's really a question this court needs to reach. But certainly for the preemption argument, my argument is that 808.03 is non-discriminatory in all respects, that every contract receives the same treatment, and that I think that the standards reflect and incorporate already any state or federal policies favoring arbitration. And I think this court could take this opportunity, if it chose to do so, to provide some guidance on that to the Court of Appeals.
Okay, thank you.
That's my argument. Is there any other questions for me today? Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to draw the court's attention to the United States Supreme Court case that we cited, KPMG versus Kachi. That case arose out of a state of Florida circuit court judge's denial of a motion to compel arbitration in a contract that adopted the FAA. In that case, the United States Supreme Court stated that the denial of that motion to compel arbitration was immediately reviewable. And it cited not to any Florida law to support that proposition, but rather it cited to the Southland versus Keating United States Supreme Court case. Again, when the United States Supreme Court has spoken on a question of federal law, I believe that it needs to be applied in this court since the arbitration agreement in place unquestionably adopts the FAA. I'd like to go back to the circuit court order because it's important to look at what it says and what it doesn't say. The circuit court order said that it concluded there was not a contract to arbitrate, quote, this case, end quote. That was because the circuit court found that the sexual event that happened in 2012, he did not believe was within the scope of the party's intentions in the terms. However, as I stated earlier, that debate over the scope of the arbitrable claims was expressly delegated to the arbitrator, and therefore the circuit court's order in its entirety is without any authority and without any power to have been made. And the Henry Schein case, unanimously issued in this past January by the United States Supreme Court, supports that conclusion.
Counsel, should we have any concern that the arbitration agreement that comes out of the admission agreement was signed after the sexual assault?
You should not, for the purposes
why?
Of why we're here, because that issue would go to whether or not the scope of the 2012 sexual event that was reported is within the scope of the contract signed in 2016. That's a debate about contract interpretation, scope, and the arbitrability of the sexual contact event. But that's been delegated to the arbitrator. So no court has any power to decide and resolve that issue. And Henry Schein tells us that very clearly.
So by contracts that are signed after an assault, the arbitrator gets to decide whether or not the prior sexual assault comes within the later signed contract.
Absolutely. It's freedom of contract, and the Henry Schein decision requires us to reach that conclusion. I would point out, too, if you wanted to have a debate about the scope of this agreement expressly says it covers any and all claims arising out of or relating, quote, in any way to LG's stay at the home. And it also says it covers any claims whether existing now or arising in the future. The contract was signed in 2016.
Yeah, I see it. 8/16/16.
Yeah. The lawsuit wasn't filed until the following year.
Well, it didn't arise then. It arose when at the time of the assault, right. Arguably, correct?
Well, that's the issue where you're saying that you're covering claims, controversies, and disputes. So the event was reported in 2012. So if you want to say that that was already a claim, it was a claim existing now at the time the contract was signed, so it's within the scope. If you want to say it didn't become a claim until the lawsuit was filed, well, then it was arising thereafter, and there's no problem there.
But wouldn't a court, though, still have the ability, regardless of arbitration clauses, to say when something was, let's call it unconscionable? Couldn't a court make a decision that this type of arbitration agreement, without the benefits, as counsel had argued, of having a guardian ad litem and really looking at the party's ability to even bargain for this, couldn't the court make that initial determination prior to talking about scope and all the other ramifications?
Well, as to your question as to unconscionability, no. The court did not have the authority to decide any unconscionability challenge to the arbitration agreement because, number one, it was delegated to the arbitrator, and, number two, it would be an attack on all five pages of the arbitration agreement, which Buckeye tells us is an attack on the contract as a whole. That would not be a challenge specifically to the validity of the Section C delegation clause on page 1. And what I just said is so important to this analysis. Because LG didn't specifically challenge the validity of Section C, the United States Supreme Court case law is clear. The circuit court had one ability and one ability only to do something, and that was to find that Section C was valid and to enforce it as written and compel the parties to arbitration. The circuit court failed to do that, and that's why this entire order is erroneous. And if we have to go all the way through a trial, I am very confident that, unfortunately, we're going to get that reversed, and LG is going to have to tell this story twice, once to a bunch of strangers in a jury in front of a judge and a bailiff, and then again in the arbitration forum. And that doesn't benefit the court. It doesn't benefit her. It doesn't benefit my client, who surely would rather have their resources being used to provide the care and services to the mentally disabled that they do on a daily basis, rather than wasting it in a court system that the intention of the parties clearly states in Section D and C they, quote, completely wanted to avoid. This contract says that the essence, it uses the word, the essence of our agreement is the intent that we will not have a judge or a jury resolve our disputes. You will find that at the top of page 2 in paragraph D. And just lastly on this issue of the permissive, you know, whether we should have just gone and asked for permission, we shouldn't have to do that. We contracted and bargained for the rules under 16A. That entitled the bargaining parties to an automatic, guaranteed, immediate right to an appeal at the outset of the case, the beginning of the case. So you should not have to ask permission for something.
Was there any reason why you couldn't have timely filed a request for appeal from the court's order?
You mean a permissive appeal?
Yes.
I could have, but again, we did that and they denied it. And that has been done in other situations where denials of motions to compel arbitration in Wisconsin have been.
Was it denied because it was untimely, or was it denied because it didn't meet the standards for permissive appeal?
I believe the decision said that the criteria for permissive appeal were not established.
Not and in this case, though, right? So you're talking about other cases?
No. In this case, and it also happened in the Cirilli case, and as I stated, it's not an appellate record yet, but it happened to me in December out of a Milwaukee County denial of a motion to compel arbitration. I took that up seeking permissive appeal and was denied, and there we go. We're at the end of the road. My client's got to go all the way through a trial and the benefits of arbitration at that point completely evaporate. They are lost forever, irreparably gone. And that's just denying the parties the benefit of the bargain of cost savings and time savings of getting into an alternative forum in arbitration at the earliest opportunity in the case. Okay. Arbitration should be first, and it should be speedy.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's not what I asked. We are adjourned, and if you can wait, students, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who's not sitting with us here, will come out and chat with you, and I'll go back and let her know that we are concluded so that she can do that. Or perhaps, Tina, you could do it. That would be great. So we are adjourned till our afternoon argument of 1:30. Thank you.